Okay, we're going to go ahead and get ready. Good morning, everybody. It's nice to see you all. We're going to go ahead and call to order our meeting of the Air Pollution Control District Board of Directors, November 13th, 2024. And with that, we're going to start with the flag salute. And if we could get a roll call, please.
Director Arnold.
I'm here.
Director Bright.
Here.
Director Darez.
Here.
Director Gibson.
Here.
Director Hammond.
Here.
Director Marks.
Here.
Director Newton is absent. Director Ortiz Legg is absent. Director Paulding.
Here.
Director Pashong.
Here.
Director Seacrest.
Here.
Director Wixom.
Okay, we'll go to the consent agenda. And does the board, any of our board members have any questions on any of the consent agenda items, items A1 through A4? Seeing none, I'm gonna go to public comment. Is there any public comment on the consent agenda? Seeing none, we have a motion by Supervisor Gibson.
Second.
And a tie second by Ms. Bright and Ms. Wixom. We'll go with Ms. Bright. Motion passes. Moving on to, roll call vote, sorry.
Technicality, but.
I'm still waking up, thanks.
Director Arnold.
Yes.
Director Darez.
Yes.
Director Hammond.
Aye.
Director Marks.
Yes.
Director Paulding.
Yes.
Director Pashong. Director Seacrest.
Yes.
Director Wixom.
Yes.
Director Bright.
Yes.
Director Gibson.
Yes.
The motion passes unanimously.
Thank you. Excellent. Let's go ahead and move on to public comment. Anybody here would like to make a public comment? Seeing no one in the room, we will go ahead and move on to the APCO's report. And today we have Carl Tupper presenting in lieu of Mr. Willie. Hope he's doing well.
Yes, thank you, Supervisor Paulding. Yes, APCO Gary Willie is doing well. I'm the assistant APCO Carl Tupper, and I'm sitting in for him today because he had heart surgery on November 4th, as I think most people here know. I just talked to him on the phone. He sounds really good. He sounds like his old self. The surgery went as expected. You know, he was in the ICU for a day or two and then kind of stepped down to a regular hospital unit, and he's currently in an acute care facility. But he should be home soon, and he may even start checking emails and, you know, working remotely for a few hours a day next week or so. We do expect him to be out for the entire month of November and not be back in the office until December. But it's a good report. He, as I said, it went well. He sounds good. So he would like me to express our recognition and appreciation for two board members who will not be joining us next year. Debbie Arnold has been on the board for 12 years and has chosen to not seek re-election. But she was our chair back in 2017, and we'll miss you, Debbie. And then also Karen Bright. She's also been on our board for a total of 12 years, although not consecutively, and was our chair last year. Thank you, Mayor Bright. So moving on, National Drive Electric Week was September 26th through October 6th, and we had one of our staff members, Tom Hickey, out there at a few community events to promote electric vehicles and infrastructure funding opportunities. On September 26th, he was at the downtown Slow Farmers Market for the Electrify Your Life Showcase. On the 28th, he was at the EV Ride and Drive Showcase at the Madonna Inn. And on October 16th, he was at the Central Coast Sustainability Summit at UCSB, showcasing one of our all-electric vehicles that's part of our fleet. So it was a great opportunity to interact with the public, but in addition to that, Tom was able to network with some other organizations and identify some potential new partners and additional funding opportunities. So it was a fruitful endeavor. Walk and Roll to School Day happened on October 9th. Every year we partner with Rideshare to promote that event. And this year we were at a South County elementary school, and we had almost 300 kids participate. So great success. We partner with numerous agencies across the county to work with local schools through the Safe Routes to School Task Force. And we do giveaways and prizes and just have lots of fun to try to encourage students to try out some alternative forms of transportation. For the grant update, later today we'll have Megan Field present the annual grant report that was postponed from last meeting, the September board meeting that got pushed to this meeting. So I'll just let Megan talk about the grant update. Later today, I will be presenting our annual air toxic hotspots report for 2023. So this is a report that we used to prepare annually and bring to the board every year on consent. Several years ago, actually before I even started working for the district, we stopped doing that report, and a lot of other districts did as well. But it turns out that the report is actually a requirement of the Health and Safety Code. So we're getting back on it. We'll do that today, and you can expect to see it on the agenda annually moving forward. We're also required to distribute that report to the Board of Supervisors and to all the city councils. So you may have seen that cross your desk. That went out on October 30th or 31st. We're required to distribute it. There's no requirement in the Health and Safety Code for you guys to do anything with it. And related to that, and as Gary noted in his last APCO report, there's some new emissions reporting requirements that are kicking in for small and medium-sized districts like us. So that those kick in for 2024 data reported next year in 2025. So the revised regulations are bringing in new facilities that previously were not required to report, lots more individual chemicals that need to be reported. Unlike a lot of other districts, we already query all of our permitted sources annually, so that part, we're well set up for that. But there are some new requirements, so we might have to request a little bit more from certain facilities than they're used to. So there might be a little bit of a learning curve. But anyways, that's coming down the pike. For the Oceano Dunes program, there are two sort of notable items. One is the 2024 annual report and work plan, and the second is the hearing board meeting that we had. And I'll get to both of those. But first, for context, I want to talk a little bit about the air quality that we've been seeing on the Mesa. So in 2023, we had the fewest number of exceedances of the state PM10 standard at CDF and at Mesa 2, so the fewest ever. So nice downward trend there. Year to date, so as of Monday, we had even fewer this year at those sites than we did, through the same date the previous year. So that trend seems to be continuing through 2024. Another indicator that we look at are just the number of hours over 300 micrograms per cubic meter for PM10. And 2023 had the fewest ever at CDF with only two for the entire year. Before we started the stipulated order of abatement process, we would have 50 to 100 such hours per year. So again, really nice downward trend. It's working for sure, yeah. And year to date, again, through Monday, we've had no hours at CDF, which is the same as last year through the same date, and seven at Mesa 2, which is the same as it was last year at this point. And then there's lots of other metrics, and they all show downward trends as these other ones I've just discussed. The only other one I'll mention is Rule 1001. We had the fewest violations of that last year with only 11 so far versus more than 50 a year before the SOA. I don't have a year to date on that one, but in summary, we're seeing really nice downward trends that have continued this year, even though the footprint of the mitigation measures has not increased from last year. We're still seeing air quality improvements as that vegetation takes hold and grows. So that's a little bit of background to what's happened in the last couple of months since the last board meeting. So as I mentioned, we approved the second draft of the 2024 annual report and work plan, the ARWP, after holding the required public workshop on October 15th. Between the initial draft we received and the final draft we approved, there were only a few minor, mostly editorial changes. So some highlights. There are 740 acres of dust controls out there right now, which is unchanged from last year. And there's no new acreage plan for the coming year. However, the last of the temporary projects, like there's some wind fencing out there, maybe some straw treatments, those are going to be converted to permanent vegetation. The modeling disclosed in the ARWP shows that emissions today are less than they were in 1939, which is before significant disturbance by off-roading. And that's the goal of the SOA, is to get current emissions to a level that is at or below where they were before significant disturbance. So that's the model. There are some loose ends with the modeling, some minor tweaks that have been identified that are needed to make it more accurate. So before we can say with full confidence that yes, the dust has been abated and we really have met that goal, we want to make sure those changes happen, kind of tie up those loose ends. We don't expect that these changes are going to change that overall conclusion, but again, we can't really make that conclusion until we've buttoned everything up. However, if that conclusion does change and it turns out that we have some more emissions to go, we have to mitigate some more, then parks will be required to do that. And then finally, these modeled reductions, as I mentioned, we're seeing nice trends with the measured data downwind. So we think that the monitoring data really corroborates these modeled results. The other big item with the Oceano Dunes is, of course, the hearing board meeting that happened on October 15th. So at the hearing board, we took a proposed amendment to the SOA to them. The last time the SOA was modified was in 2022. And the three main changes that were sought with this amendment are, number one, to, as previously amended, the SOA would have ended in December 2025. And what we requested was to extend that out to December 2028. We wanted to do that because, again, we're still tweaking the model, so it's nice to have a little bit more time to work with that. And again, if it does turn out that more on-the-ground projects are needed, that gives us a few more years to make sure that happens. But the big one is really to give us time to do some confirmatory monitoring. Again, the trends all look really good, but we want to make sure that those emissions reductions are sustainable and that State Park can remain in compliance. So this gives us a few more years just to keep an eye on things and make sure that these gains that we've achieved are sustained. The second item in the requested modification has to do with the goals. So as previously modified, the SOA had what we called an initial goal of reducing emissions to pre-disturbance levels, and then required that parks gain approval of a final excess emissions goal by a certain date, which happened to be the day after the meeting. So again, the hearing board was supposed to just approve sort of what the goal is, not necessarily that the goal had been achieved, just what is the goal. And so this modification basically says that initial goal, we're going to call that the final goal. So that is the goal. So in approving the modification, they would be just kind of putting their stamp on like, yes, the goal is to get emissions down to pre-disturbance levels. And then finally, the third item that we thought that we sought was to put a deadline into the order by which state parks would have to demonstrate that they had in fact achieved that goal. And so that date we put in there was October 28th. So by October 2028, state parks would have to obtain hearing board approval that the goal has been met. And so that was the proposed order, and the hearing board indeed approved that by a vote of 5-4. They also went a little bit further though. The public, certain members of the public, public commenters, and I think the hearing board itself was a little bit uncomfortable with compliance being based solely on modeling, right? State Parks is doing the modeling, and you know the modeling says we're in compliance, but they wanted a compliance mechanism that's based on actual measured data, something we can independently verify. So as I've noted, all of our monitoring data, all of our metrics are showing that PM is declining as expected, but we really don't have a firm number of like, well, what should these numbers look like if we are in compliance, or what would air quality look like on the Mesa if it's not in compliance. So the hearing board passed a motion unanimously directing staff to develop an air quality metric for judging compliance with the SOA and to present that to the hearing board at the next meeting. So, you know, probably, so we're going to be working on that. It'll probably be, you know, it'll entail something to do with actual monitored data. No more than this many exceedances, keeping the ratio of CDF to Osoflaco below a certain level, something like that. But it's going to be based on actual, what the hearing board wants is something based on actual monitored data rather than modeled result. So anyways, we're going to be working on that. The next hearing, they set their next meetings for June of 2025 and again, October of 2025. So that is my update on Oceano. And then the last item I wanted to talk about, which is really exciting, is the burn program. So staff is preparing for the upcoming burn season. And backyard burn season is not opened yet. Again, all backyard burning in the county requires a permit from us. Hasn't opened yet. Typically opens in late November or December. Last year it was December 4th. So there's some exciting changes for this year. As you might recall, as of last year, CAL FIRE has also been requiring a permit. So last year people were required to get a permit from us and also from CAL FIRE. And there's a lot of confusion around that. And it's just, you know, inconvenient. One more layer of red tape for people to jump through. So we've been collaborating with CAL FIRE. Alyssa has been point person on that, and also our IT person, Jason Dornish, has really been doing a lot of heavy lifting, working hand in hand with CAL FIRE to make our permit a one-stop shop. So people will be able to come to us, get their backyard burn permit, or in most cases, even their ag burn permit, and at the same time be issued their CAL FIRE permit. So we're excited about that. We're still kind of tweaking that, but we expect that to be ready to roll by the time backyard burn season opens. And so all backyard burners and most ag burners will be able to use this one-stop shop and get their APCD burn permit and their CAL FIRE LE62A burn permit in one step. Certain ag burners, bigger projects, will still need to get a separate type of permit from CAL FIRE. But, you know, most of the people who are burning, this is going to be a one-stop shop. So that's really exciting. And in addition to that, we're developing an online form for new backyard and ag burn permit applications. So currently, if you've already had an ag burn permit, you can renew it online. Or if you've already had a backyard burn permit, you can renew it online. But if you're a new burner, you need to get a paper form, fill it out, drop it off, mail it in. You can still pay online, but you know there's this. You got to do something with paper and pen. Right. So with this new system, we'll be completely online. You'll be able to go to our website and apply for your backyard burn permit or ag burn permit or renew your previous burn permit all online. So we're really excited about that. I think it's going to be great for the public. And it's also takes, you know, it's been a heavy lift to get it going, but it's going to make stuff easier on our end too with processing all these permits. And then lastly, we are in the prescribed burn season. We recently had two big burns completed, the Sequoia Riverlands Trust burn of about 200 acres in California Valley has been completed since the last meeting, and also the Yarrow Vegetation Management Plan, which is kind of in the Park Hill Road area. They burned approximately 100 acres in the last month and making good progress on that VMP. So we continue to work closely with land managers on these prescribed burn projects. And that's about it. That ends the APCO report. I'm happy to answer any questions that folks might have.
Thank you, Carl. That was a great report. Any questions from our board members? Supervisor Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Carl, what was the vote? Could you tell me again the vote on your proposed amendment?
The proposed amendment was 5-4 in favor. It passed.
How did we end up with 9 votes on a 5-member board?
It was 5 out of 4. Yes, I misspoke. So one person voted no.
Four out of five. 4-1.
4 out of 5.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. I thought somebody packed the hearing board.
No. Sorry about that. Yeah, looking at my notes. Okay. Wrote it weirdly. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
And then second, the motion to come up with a metric was unanimous.
Yeah.
Was there any discussion at that point about using the framework of Rule 1001 as the metric? Because that really is the comparison of undisturbed versus disturbed.
Yeah. There was some discussion of that. You know, the SAG has expressed concern about the comparison specifically between CDF and Oso Flacco, with the concern being that, you know, Rule 1001 is based on comparing, as you said, a control site.
A particular control site with a particular disturbed site.
Yeah. And the thing with Rule 1001 with Oso Flacco is it doesn't really represent the dunes in their natural state, because it's there have been vegetation projects in there to restore dune vegetation, and there's also been some invasive species moving in. So there's actually more vegetation in that area now than there was in pre-disturbance conditions. And then there probably would be, you know, if it were not for these unnatural activities. So
all I was headed for was, it seems my thought, my suggestion would be understanding the details of coming up with a proper control versus a fair measurement, a fair observation of the disturbed area. That framework seems to be the right framework. And if that modifies Rule 1001 in the end, so be it. But I think I'd like to see that idea provided to the SAG for their deliberations.
Yes, absolutely. One thing that we will explore is just that, is some kind of like, what should the comparison between Oso Flacco and CDF or some other site be? So we're going to be looking at that for sure.
Great. Thank you.
Board Member Hammond.
Thank you. Thank you, Jimmy. Kurt, great report on the dunes. Again, it's definitely working. This is what we've been working for so many years. My question was on the burn. Is this all in unincorporated areas, or are there areas of cities that still allow burning? I'm not sure. I know Paso doesn't, but...
Right. Yeah, so backyard burning is only allowed outside of the... urban reserve line. So outside of all the cities and even a lot of unincorporated areas is the only place you can do backyard burning. Ag burning is a little bit different. Ag burning is not allowed in most cities, but there are a few cities where you can get an ag burn permit. But typically, we have to issue that. They need a permit from us and from the municipality if they're going to do ag burning within the URL, VRL. We don't see a lot of that, but we do issue a handful of such permits every year.
Mm-hmm. And this online system that we have, did we already have that in place, or is that something you have put in place to do it online?
It's going to be new. So up till now, people have been able to renew their permits if they already had one. What's going to be new is that brand new burners will be able to apply. But all of this geographical stuff will be in there. Like if you try to get a backyard burn permit in the city of Paso, it's going to bounce you out.
Got it. All right. Thank you.
Yep.
Any other questions from members of the board or comments? Got a couple comments. First, just going back to your report, Carl, on Walk to School Day, I want to recognize Megan Field for doing a great job. I mean, you were so prepared for the onslaught of the kiddos, and they took it seriously at Harlow. I mean, it was just kids coming from every direction. So really appreciate your work. And it shows that if we take it seriously and we partner with SlowCog, et cetera, we can really encourage the kids to walk to school or bike. Secondly, thank you so much to Mayor Bright and to Supervisor Arnold for your many years of service to this board. We really appreciate that. And then great report on the Oceano Dunes. Sounds like we're making some great progress, and looks like the hearing board is headed in the right direction, and I certainly echo Supervisor Gibson's comments on that. So, and then, of course, the burn program. I think that's great. So, all right, seeing no other comments from the board. Oh, Supervisor Pichon.
Yep, I just wanted to, I did Walk to School Day, as I have for the last 8 years at Templeton Elementary. This time we ran out of stickers, so I'm just putting in my order now for next year. Thank you.
And we ran out of those little paper airplane things. Those were, yeah, Ms. Seacrest. Yeah, they're pretty cool. Thank
you. I just wanted to give another shout out to Alyssa and Jason for all of their work on the new reporting system that's going to, I think it's also going to clear up a lot of confusion, it sounded like, just when I spoke to them earlier this week, really clear it up in terms of CAL FIRE versus APCD. So thank you.
Okay, we'll go ahead and move on to board business. And the first item is item B1. I'll turn it back over to you, Carl. Or no, this is Megan. All right.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Megan Field. I'm the PIO and an air quality specialist here at the Air District. And like Carl mentioned, this report is typically done in September, so thank you for waiting until November for me. I am the program manager for several grant programs that we have at the Air District. I help run Farmer, which is our ag replacement tractor replacement program, marine vessel replacement, clean air rooms, and soon to be coming lawn and garden. And so today I'm going to be talking a little bit about our grant program in the past fiscal year, what programs we funded, the outreach efforts that we took to ensure everyone in our community is aware of the programs that we offer at the Air District. So the APCD has been administering our grants since 1997, so we're in the 27th year of our grant program administration. And in those 27 years, we've awarded over $39.2 million to local businesses, individuals, and agencies to reduce emissions of their equipment. And from that money, we have realized 3,383 tons of emission reductions. That's equivalent to retiring approximately 35,000 cars in our historic old car buyback program, or about 730 old wood stoves with our wood smoke reduction program. Historically, as you can see, the largest funding categories have been our local DMV funds. These are registration fees paid to the DMV and are set aside exclusively for emission reduction projects. Also, the state Carl Moyer funds, these are funds for grants received from smog checks and tire disposal fees. And then we also have large-scale construction projects. This is where the local mitigation fees come in. When construction projects exceeded our emission thresholds, they would pay funding to offset those emissions, and we would do grant programs. And then also there's the state's greenhouse gas reduction fund. And so those are from the state's cap and trade program. And those funds, they fund multiple programs that we do, like our farmer program, our community air protection program, and our wood smoke, countywide wood smoke reduction program. So overall, the almost $40 million represents the just about $3.5 million in funds that were authorized by your board in fiscal year 23-24, and approximately $500,000 in administration funds that were authorized in that same year. So this slide shows the list of available grant project categories that we currently support. The Carl Moyer and related programs is the largest category there, and all of the programs listed use the Carl Moyer guidelines or CAP guidelines, even if the funding comes from another source. So they all rely on those Carl Moyer program guidelines to administer the program. Also continuing this year, we have our school bus replacement program and our wood smoke reduction program. We also did our second round of our clean air rooms program. That was very successful, and we were able to get, I'll talk about it a little bit more, but we got almost all of the air purifiers in the hands of our low-income community members, so that was really exciting. And then, like I mentioned, coming soon, our lawn and garden electrification program will be coming this next year. So shifting gears from allocations now to expenditures that we had in fiscal year 23-24, we funded just under $3 million in projects, and so we've been very busy getting that money out in the community. The largest share of expenditures were from the Carl Moyer and the Farmer Program, together providing over $2 million to local businesses and individuals to get them into cleaner agricultural equipment and off-road equipment. I'll take a little bit more time to talk about each one of those categories a little bit. And the total emission reductions for these projects in the past fiscal year was 40.68 tons of emission reduction over the term of the contracted lives with these projects. And so really the total emissions will even be greater, total emission reductions will even be greater because the projects and the equipment last well past their contracted lives. All right, I'll talk a little bit about one of the biggest programs we funded this past fiscal year. This was our off-road equipment replacement program. And so this replaces old agricultural tractors and construction equipment with the newest, cleanest equipment available. So in the previous fiscal year, we had over $1.5 million went to local agriculturalists to replace 19 ag tractors. That's $1.5 million that was right into the hands of our local businesses, owners, and residents. And not only do the new pieces of equipment operate cleaner, we're told by many of the farmers that the equipment is much more fuel efficient, up to 50% more fuel efficient than their old pieces of equipment. Next is our marine vessel replacement program. In the past fiscal year, we spent over $676,000 over four marine projects, cleaning up not just blue skies, but also our waters. This is an exciting project because it's been hard to get out into our marine community and get projects done. And so while this number says four marine engine projects, it's actually more like six. We just included those in the previous fiscal year, but those projects also wrapped up this year. All right, next we have our EV infrastructure projects. The past fiscal year, we did actually complete two projects for just over $285,000. However, one of the projects, like I mentioned with Marine, was included and counted in the previous fiscal year, but we did finish it up this year, and so we're just counting the one project. But a significant chunk of this funding went to the Regional Transportation Authority to help them fund their massive EV infrastructure project that they've been working on out there at their new facility. And this project not only helped fund several of their large-scale bus chargers, but it also helped with some of the overhead charging capabilities and some of their trenching. So the facility will be ready to scale as they work to expand their EV fleet. And then we'll be finishing up this program in this fiscal year, but in fiscal year 23-24, we were able to get out 299 air purifiers to some of our low-income residents across Slo County. And in my opinion, other than the program, you know, helping people with a cleaner indoor living environment, it's really amazing how many communities this program touched. We had people from Napomo to Paso and San Simeon, from Pozo to Cambria and San Simeon. So every single community had somebody that was able to benefit from this program. So as all of you know, with any successful program, outreach is a huge component of all of our grant programs. We work closely with local equipment dealers for our replacement and repower programs, as well as our wood stove programs. We also do specific targeted advertisements and direct outreach and participate in community events across the county and in neighboring counties. This year in particular, especially with our Clean Air Rooms program, we worked really closely with organizations like the Promotores Collaborative, Diversity Coalition, and Corazon Latino to ensure everyone in our county, regardless of the language that they speak or the way they get their information, is aware of the programs that we offer and has the ability to participate in our programs. So for our Clean Air Rooms in particular, we launched an online form for that program, and it was available in English and Spanish, so that there was no barrier to apply. In the past several years, we've really tried to be more effective in our communication engagement, our community engagement, and prioritizing people, trying to minimize those barriers and help with understanding of all of our programs, and we're constantly fine-tuning and expanding on our outreach program. So here's looking ahead at the next year. The legislature has slated approximately $2.5 million for our grant programs that we run. As you can see, here's some of the proposed funding allocations for some of the largest grant programs that we do. And so with the ebb and flow, we're always looking for innovative and creative ideas to ensure that our funding provides the maximum cost effectiveness and the maximum and provides funding to the most amount of residents in our county. A big bummer that we had this year was that unfortunately Farmer was not included in the state's budget. So that was, you know, depending on the year, $500,000 to an $800,000 hit for us. So we're shifting how we're doing some of our programs, and we'll be focusing some funding on specific agricultural projects for next year. All right, and so at this time, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that great presentation and progress report on our programs. Any questions by members of the board? Supervisor Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Megan, looking at the gross overall total, $39 million, 3,380 some tons reduced, that's $11,000 a ton. Now, these are criteria pollutants and some greenhouse gas reduction. Ballpark figure for reducing greenhouse gas is a whole lot less than 11,000. Are we tracking the cost effectiveness of this, and do we have the flexibility to direct these funds to the most cost effective way of doing it? I know it, last I remember, as long as we were under $15,000 or $16,000 of a ton, we were meeting state requirements, but I'm curious as to the great disparity in the cost of reducing a ton of CO2 versus a ton of one of the criteria pollutants.
Yeah, so as you can imagine, as things get cleaner, that cost effectiveness value continues to rise. Yeah. And so where we were at one time at that 15,000 mark, this past year we've been operating at about $34,000.
And that's I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's within state.
Yes, that's the Carl Moyer guidelines is the guidelines that we operate under, and that's their criteria. However, for this next year, that is also going to be changing. And so they're looking at about $60,000 for the agricultural tractors, like a diesel-to-diesel tractor. However, zero-emission projects, they're looking, I think it was at $100,000 for that cost-effectiveness value. But we're tracking every project that we do. And at this time, we have a first-come, first-serve program. And so if you turn in your application and it's complete, then we work with you and move forward with the project. And so we go based in order of how they're received. At this time, we don't have a program where we're doing some sort of ranking system to determine which projects are most cost-effective. That could be something that we look at in the future as things become more expensive and we want to get that lower-hanging
fruit. Yeah. Is there any sense at the state level that the state is headed to, I mean, given the budget challenges this year, next year, for who knows how many more years, I wonder if the state's starting to take a little closer look at the cost effectiveness of this.
I think so, but at this time I'm not sure if they would, you know, require of the guidelines to do some sort of ranking system. I think they look at what they consider to be an average cost effectiveness of lots of these projects and try to have a number that they can stand behind.
And that's set by CARB yearly?
Correct.
Yearly.
Yeah. Okay. There have been changes the past several years, but there will be like a period of a couple years where we'll go with the same cost effectiveness. It just kind of depends.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Board Member Marks.
Thank you, Chair Paulding. I had two questions. One about the DMV funds. Is this per vehicle, and does it include electric cars, EV cars?
That's a good question. To answer your first piece, it's when all of us pay a registration fee at the DMV, there will be like a dollar amount that is set aside for air quality, and that goes to the air district, and we use it for grant administration and projects. And EVs have the same thing. Yes, EVs have the same thing. So they're also paying towards emission reduction projects.
Okay. And this is separate from the gas tax.
Correct.
Gas tax.
Correct.
Okay, thanks. And the other question that I had was whether the APCD is reaching out to Central Coast Community Energy, 3CE, regarding electrification of agricultural equipment, like tractors.
Yeah, we... Andy Metzger in our office works really closely with 3CE on several of the programs, and we always include them in our correspondence when we launch new programs.
Right. So January 1st, the unincorporated part of the county will become a full member of 3CE. And
correct.
I think I'm on the policy board of that group right now. And there's always kind of a struggle to find appropriate and qualified recipients of these program monies that they have. They're really interested, especially around Salinas and the Central Valley, in terms of electrifying agricultural equipment. So I think even though the farmer program has been discontinued, it's possible that from another angle, there will be more grant possibilities for
for zero emission
for the farmers.
Yeah,
ranchers. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's all I have.
Excellent. Any other questions from members of the board? Seeing none, I'm going to go to public comment on this item. Anybody have any public comment? Seeing none, I think this is just a receive and file, so we'll go ahead and move on. But
thank you very much
for the great report.
Yeah.
We'll move to item B2.
All right, yes, thank you, Chair Paulding. Carl Tupper, again, Assistant APCO, talking about our AB 2588 Air Toxics Hotspots Report for 2023. So as I mentioned, this is a report that we used to do annually, haven't been doing it for a while, but we're restarting it. And so this falls out of AB 2588, which is the Air Toxics Hotspots Assessment, and I forget the full name of it. But anyways, it's a state law regulation that was passed in 1987, and it was really motivated by concerns around things like you see here, like chemical plants, refineries, toxic waste situations, and a lot of that was on, I think, people's minds in the 80s. That's when DTSC was, the Department of Toxic Substance Control, kind of came on board. There was a lot of regulation happening, I think, in the wake of Love Canal and some of these bigger environmental disasters. So that was the motivation behind this bill. Luckily, we don't really have any of these iconic sources of air toxics in our community. There is, of course, the P66 or Phillips 66 refinery, which is, in the grand scheme of things, a pretty small refinery, and it hasn't accepted crude in almost 2 years. It's being shut down. But we do have lots of these smaller sources of toxic emissions. So gasoline itself is full of some toxic compounds like benzene, toluene, hexane, things like that. And every time a car fills up its tank or every time a tanker drops fuel into the underground tanks of a gas station, there are some releases into the air. So gas stations are a source of toxic air emissions. Whoops, sorry. Dry cleaners, a lot of dry cleaners in the county, they all used to use tetrachloroethylene, otherwise known as PERC, which is a toxic compound. Luckily, PERC has been phased out, and these dry cleaners are now using non-toxic solvents. But at least historically, and certainly in 1997, dry cleaners were a concern. Auto body shops, a lot of the coatings can contain things like xylenes, PCBTF, and other things in their solvents that can have a toxic component. Incinerators, in particular crematories, we worry about things like heavy metals and dioxin emissions. And then finally, a big category at the bottom here is stationary engines. So we have lots of diesel-powered backup generators in the county. Diesel emissions, diesel particulate matter is a carcinogen, also causes chronic health issues. We're a smaller amount, but we're seeing more and more of these natural gas-powered backup engines, and they can emit things like formaldehyde and acrolein, things that can also be toxic. So what's the regulatory framework? Again, we're talking about mostly the AB 2588 from 1987, the Air Toxic Hotspots Information and Assessment Act. This is a bill that requires that a facility-wide assessment of risk. So not, you know, a big facility might have several potential sources in it. There might be the refinery, for example. It's got big boilers. It's got process units. There are diesel backup generators. It has a wastewater treatment plant. They use lots of coatings to kind of keep in their maintenance. All of these are potentially sources of toxic emissions. And while there might be specific emission limits for each of these processes that come from federal, state, or local rules, what's the total facility-wide air emissions and the total risk from the facility from all these little components? So that's what AB 25 gets at, is the facility-wide risk. And a companion to that is our local rule 219, which came on board in 1999. So AB 2588 kind of was meant to capture everything as it stood at the time, and then District Rule 219 captures new sources. So any new source of potential toxic emissions or any modification which could potentially increase toxic emission needs to get reviewed for their facility-wide risk, and there are thresholds that risk cannot exceed these certain thresholds, which we'll get into. So that's really what we're talking about here is facility-wide risk as opposed to these specific emission limits on for different types of sources. So when AB 2588 first came out, it initially applied only to large facilities, like you see here in the background, the Morro Bay Power Plant, which of course is no longer operational. Basically, large facilities that emitted at least 10 tons per year of any criteria pollutant, and then certain other industries that were sort of known to have toxic emissions. So metal plating, things using cadmium or chromium, the use of ethylene oxide in sterilization, things like that. Since then, the scope has been widened a few different times, and now the thresholds are lower, and we're bringing in more and more facilities. But at least initially, it was just kind of aimed at these larger facilities. And what AB 2588 requires is, first of all, that these facilities report their toxic emissions to the district, and then that their risk is assessed, their toxic risk to their neighbors is looked at. And then, based on what that risk is, we prioritize facilities. We have high priority facilities, intermediate and low priority facilities. And for those facilities in the high priority category, they're required to notify their neighbors and to ultimately reduce their risk, perhaps by changing their process, perhaps by installing additional pollution control equipment, but they are required to do risk reduction to get out of that high priority category. And then facilities are periodically reassessed to make sure that they don't become high priority facilities and trigger that requirement for notification and risk reduction. So how do we look at risk? There's two related concepts. There's risk assessment and risk prioritization. And I'll talk a little bit about both of those. But in general, we're considering cancer effects, and then non-cancer, chronic, so long-term health impacts, and then acute impacts from short-term exposure, from one-hour exposure. And the different components that go into the risk assessment or risk prioritization are the emissions, the dispersion. So you've got, pollutants being emitted at a certain rate. How does that translate to concentrations on the ground where somebody could be breathing it? We look at the potency of these emissions. Some things cause cancer, some things don't. Some things are very powerful carcinogens. Some things might cause cancer, but only at extreme doses. So we take all that into account. And then also the receptor, by which we mean who is it that's being exposed. Some people are more sensitive to these effects than other people, and their lifestyle or the exact situation may dictate how much of a dose they get. And we'll get into that. But I'll just also say the methodology that we use is approved methodology either from CAPCOA or from the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, OEHA. We're experts in air pollution, but we're not experts. We're not doctors or toxicologists, epidemiologists. So we take the guidance that these experts have come up with, and we apply it to the facilities in our district. So how do we calculate risk? So we start with a facility. It's emitting something that has some toxic component to it. And so the first component is the emissions. What are they? What's being emitted? Specifically, what specific chemicals and at what specific rates, both how much on an annual basis and then also on an hourly basis. The next part is that dispersion part, and this is really the hardest part. So how do those emission rates translate into concentrations on the ground where people could be exposed? That depends on, of course, the distance between the source and the receptor, how tall is that smokestack, what's its diameter, what's the temperature of the emissions, what's the velocity that is being pushed into the atmosphere. Meteorology plays a big deal. If you could be right, you could be upwind of a major polluter, but if you're upwind, the wind's taking the pollution away from you and you're not exposed. And then, of course, what's in between the receptor and the source, the terrain, are there other buildings that could affect dispersion? So all of that potentially goes into the calculation of risk. We look at the receptor, so who's being exposed, breathing rates and change over time. People's lifestyle may affect how frequently they're exposed. So at a minimum, we always look at residential exposure, which we assume to be over a person's lifetime, 7 days a week, starting at birth. It's very conservative, very worst case scenario. And then we also look at offsite workers. So, you know, on-site worker exposure is handled by OSHA and those type of rules. But once you get offsite, that's what we look at. And so there we're assuming a worker potentially working for 25 years next to this toxic source, but that person's only there 5 days a week, and their exposure starts when they're an adult as opposed to starting at birth. And then lastly, the potency of the compound. How bad is this stuff? We'll look at compound-specific dose response for cancer. It's the unit risk value, which basically relates a dose to a probability of getting cancer. And then for chronic and acute effects, we look at the REL, the reference exposure level. So reference exposure level is a level below which exposure is believed to be to not carry any adverse health effects. And these values, again, we're not coming up with these values. They come from CARB. They come from OEHA. So putting it all together, in a formal health risk assessment, we use computer modeling to take into account all these various dispersion parameters, meteorology, the emission rates, stack parameters, and we calculate cancer risk in terms of excess cancers per million people. So without this source, there's some background rate of cancer. With this source, we expect cancer to increase by, you know, 10, 20, 100 million, or 10, 20, 100 people per million people, okay? Ideally, you do this right, you get a map like this with isopleths on it. So, you know, within this isopleth, the cancer risk is 10 in a million. Within this bigger isopleth, it's between 10 and 1 and whatnot. We do the same thing for chronic risk, where we calculate an HHI, a health hazard index, which is basically the ratio of the concentration on the ground to that REL. So again, the REL is kind of like the level below which we don't expect adverse health effects. So are we well below the REL? Are we at the REL? Are we above the REL? That's what the HHI tells us. And we do the same thing for acute risk. So that's a formal health risk assessment. Very complicated, lots of effort. There's also the prioritization score, which is what we do at the district, where we're really just trying to rank facilities by degree of risk. It's very unrefined, very, very health conservative, especially compared to a health risk assessment. And we talk about scores rather than risk estimates. It relies on very standard assumptions. It's kind of a one-size-fits-all approach to looking at risk. And again, it's just meant to be a screening tool to figure out kind of quickly, like, what are our highest priority facilities that we need to focus on. So comparing the HRA to prioritization score, again, the district performs prioritization. And for high priority facilities, we will then ask the facility to perform a formal health risk assessment. And they'll usually have a contractor do that for them. The methodology for these two things is different, but it's the approved guidelines for either CAPCOA or OEHA. In terms of complexity, prioritization is pretty simple. Once we know what a facility's emissions are, we can pretty quickly develop a prioritization score. We can do it in bulk in a computer program for several facilities at once. Whereas a health risk assessment is very complicated. Again, there's computer modeling. The report on an HRA for a single facility could run in hundreds of pages long. And the main difference in the methodology is dispersion. How do emission rates translate into concentrations on the ground? With a health risk assessment, we're going to use a computer model that's going to take into account, you know, 5 years of meteorology at the site, terrain, the stack parameters, things like that. and give a refined estimate of concentration. Whereas under prioritization, we're really only considering how far is the receptor from the source, what's the stack height. We look those numbers up in a table and put that into our calculation. It's very simple. But those assumptions are very, very conservative. It's really a worst-case scenario. With receptors, for prioritization score, we're considering residential exposure of 70 years and worker exposure of 25 years. Health risk assessment can be more refined. And then lastly, I've already mentioned, a priority score is going to give us, or a prioritization gives us priority scores for cancer, acute and chronic effects, whereas a risk assessment is going to give us actual risk estimates for those effects. So what's the AB2588 process? So the district prioritizes its facilities, the facilities that meet the applicability for AB2588. If the cancer score is greater than 10, or if the acute or chronic score is greater than 1, then we categorize it as high priority, and an HRA is going to be required. If the cancer score is less than 1, or if the acute and chronic scores are less than 0.1, then it's a low-priority facility, and it's exempt from the Air Toxic Hotspots Program. And then scores in between, we categorize it as intermediate priority, and we're going to periodically reassess them to make sure that they don't need to get bumped up to high priority. These thresholds were adopted by the board back in 1990, and these are in line with the thresholds of the other districts in California. All the small and medium districts have thresholds at these levels. No one has lower thresholds, but some of the larger districts that have more people and more sources actually have higher scores. So for us, a cancer score of 20 would make you a high priority facility. In some other districts, that might slot you into intermediate priority. And so for those high priority facilities that are required to do an HRA, they do an HRA, and if the cancer risk from that HRA were to be over 10 in a million, or if the HHI was to be over 1, then they would be a high priority facility. They would stay in the program, and there'd be some additional requirements. Again, if it comes out to less than 1 in a million, and chronic and acute HHIs are both less than 0.1, then the facility would be exempt from the program. And if you're in the middle, it's an intermediate priority facility, and it's periodically reassessed. So for those high priority facilities, high priority after doing an HRA, they would be required to notify the public and to reduce their cancer risk to less than 10 in a million and their HHIs to less than 1. This has never happened in the district. There have been a few facilities that have been prioritized as high priority, and they were required to do HRAs, and those HRAs demonstrated risks that were below the high priority threshold. So they're required to reduce risk to get to at least intermediate priority, in which case they would then be required to periodically reassess. So a few more notes. As I said, HRA is much more refined than prioritization, and to date, no facilities that have been required to do an HRA have demonstrated risks that would put them in the high priority category. Intermediate priority facilities, we periodically look at them to make sure we don't need to bump them up. And then low priority facilities are exempted, but they might still need to be reassessed if they have changes in their operation or emissions, if homes get built around them, so now there's closer receptors. If OEHA says, we thought this stuff was this toxic, and in fact it's really this toxic, then that might trigger reassessment. And a big one is the underlying regulation has changed, most recently in 2022. So for example, as it was initially promulgated in 1997, a diesel backup generator was exempt from the program unless it used more than 3,000 gallons of fuel per year. So that exempted all but the biggest diesel engines. In 2007, it was revised to a threshold of 40 hours per year. So as long as you were using less than 40 hours, running it for less than 40 hours a year, you were exempt. And then a couple years ago, it was revised again. That threshold is now 5 hours per year, which basically brings in like every single diesel engine in the county, because most people are exercising their engines for at least 5 hours a year. So where do we stand? So these are currently operating facilities that were required for one reason or another to do an HRA. And as you can see, in all cases, the cancer risk is less than 10, and the chronic and acute HHIs are less than 1. So all of these facilities are intermediate priority facilities. None are high priority facilities that have been required under this program to do anything to reduce their risk. In terms of district prioritization scores, we recently, or just this year, we reprioritized all of our facilities based on 2023 admissions data. The results of that, all gas stations were categorized as intermediate priority based because they all had acute scores between 0.1 and 1. And that's basically, you know, gasoline, as I mentioned earlier, has some toxic constituents. And really, gasoline stations are public places. So in an acute scenario, let's say fuel is being delivered and the station's pumping as much fuel as it can, and someone's there for an hour because it's a public place and people hang out there, that's kind of the scenario we're assessing. And again, acute scores are all less than 1, but they're above 0.1, making them intermediate priority. So we'll continue to keep them in the program and assess them annually. Dry cleaners are now all low priority because PERC has been phased out and they're all using non-toxic solvents. In terms of other facilities, most of which are diesel engines, we had 3 high priority facilities, and we'll be reaching out to these facilities and requiring that they do health risk assessments. Of course, we don't know what the results of those will be until they're done, but I'm anticipating that all 3 of these will demonstrate risks that will be less than high priority, but we'll see. And then we have another 97 facilities that are intermediate. Auto body shops, CAPCOA is currently developing guidance to do this for auto body shops. There's some new chemicals and new processes that have come online with auto body shops that make this a little bit more complicated. So we did not assess auto body shops this time, but once CAPCOA finalizes their auto body shop guidance, we will be bringing auto body shops. We'll be looking at auto body shops. And the most recent amendments to the EICG, which is kind of the implementing regulations of AB 2588, that brought in a lot more facilities that previously had been exempt, a lot of new compounds. So things are changing a little bit. These numbers, these 3 high priority facilities, 97 intermediate facilities, those are going to change because their emissions are changing, but also the requirements of the program are changing. And that's it. I'm happy to answer any questions, although at first I would like to thank our engineering team. Sarah Wade and Dave Whitney have been, they're our engineers. They've been implementing this program. And then our interns, Indigo Banjo and Elise Merritt, they did, the bulk of the work, a lot of number crunching, a lot of data entry to get the emissions into our systems and then crunch these numbers. And they did the lion's share of that, really some great work. And then her name's not on here, but I do want to mention Monica Stant. She's new. She's not on our engineering team. She's in compliance, but she comes from Shasta County where she was working in this program and preparing this report for Shasta County, and I had lots of useful discussions with her, so I'd like to acknowledge her. And that's about it. Any questions?
Thank you, Carl. From Ms. Bright.
I'm just wondering, when you say a periodic reassessment for the intermediate sources, is there any kind of a schedule for that? Or?
Yeah, so the Health and Safety Code requires at least quadrennial reassessment, so every 4 years. We have been a little bit more aggressive. We get their emissions every year. And so, potentially we could do it more frequently than every 4 years. But 4 years is the minimum.
Thank you.
Yep.
Yeah, I'll piggyback on that, and then I see we have some other questions. So the table 2 has years 2019, 2011. There's a whole range. So how are we making sure that they're filing the HRAs at the appropriate?
Yeah, that's a good question. We look at their emissions. We kind of look at what is in the HRA and what numbers were used to generate the risks that are disclosed in the HRA, and then we look at what their current emissions are. And, you know, if there are big changes, then we can ask for a new HRA.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Ms. Marks.
Yeah, I may have missed it, but I didn't see any data about the county airport.
Yeah.
I saw the Oceano Airport, which is like really small.
Yeah.
I'm just curious. I know there's a lot of jet fuel that's, you know, handled there.
Yeah, I think for the county airport, it's going to be listed as.
I mean, there's.
It's like ACI Jet, I believe. I'm looking at the report right now.
ACI Jet is another question that I had. They do a lot of refueling of military and. You know, private planes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's possible. This list is great. It's just, it's in numerical order, not alphabetical order. So for the billion trying to figure out, say, where the heck's the county airport? Are we just skipping it? Or why Oceano and not the county?
Yeah, it's definitely in here. I'm not, you know, on the fly here, flipping through the table, I'm not finding it. But it's either listed as the county airport or as ACI Jet. And I'm happy to get back to you on where it stands, but I know it's included.
Yeah, I mean, and we have these gas stations, like a single gas station, but then something like the airport, it seems to me that would just be huge, and it doesn't seem to rise to the level of, well, for instance, the city of San Luis Obispo wastewater treatment plant, I doubt it comes up with more emissions than the whole airport. So,
well, yeah,
no, I mean, this is not my area of expertise. I just am trying to figure out the criteria.
Yes, you know, for the airport, the emissions we'd be looking at would be from the pumping of avgas and also from diesel generators that might be associated with that. I don't believe we have. You know, we're not including emissions from the aircraft themselves. So I believe for the airport, it would just be those two sources, would be gasoline and diesel generators. But the other component of this is the receptors, right? There's the emissions, but also what's the actual risk where people are being exposed. And, you know, any residents and any offsite businesses are going to be quite far from those sources at the airport, whereas the wastewater treatment plant, I think, is a little bit closer into some potential receptors.
I'll just add to that. The Board of Supervisors recently approved a grant-funded program with a bunch of sustainability metrics for the airport. We now have a sustainability manager managing those programs and working to comply with state and federal law. But it's looking really good, and it's nice that SLO County's moved in that direction. Did you have any other questions? I see that Mr. Hammond has some. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Chair. Carl, this is not unlike the dunes and how we have to measure downwind exceedances and such. And so how do we have instruments that we put around these sources that we have to measure? I mean, how does that work? HRA.
Right. So that's a great question. So no, we're not measuring anything at these sources. This is all based on emissions that either they report themselves or more likely they're reporting throughput. So for a gas station, they're reporting how many gallons of gasoline did they pump for the year. For a diesel generator, they're reporting how many hours did it operate for a year. And then we have what we call emission factors, which relate throughput to the emissions.
Certain amount.
Yeah.
Released.
Right. Yep.
I see. Got it.
I'd like to piggyback on that one. You know, Dr. Robert Lapidus, who served on the hearing board, has long inquired as to why we haven't done more of a health risk assessment on the downwind population of the Oceano Dunes. And I guess my question here would be, the ODSVRA couldn't be considered a high-risk facility because it doesn't fall within the criteria pollutant standards?
Yeah, it's not a permitted facility. And, you know, it's toxic emissions. We really haven't looked at it. I think there's just two separate pathways, really. You know, with the Oceano Dunes, we were motivated by nuisance, and that's kind of what kicked off the Cipriot Orb abatement and all that stuff. Whereas this program, AB 2588, is more formal, you know, where we're required to look at permitted facilities and calculate their emissions and therefore do an HRA. With the dunes, I'm not sure what authority would have to require an HRA, and I'm also not sure how we would really use that, because we're already requiring them. Like with this program, they have to do an HRA, and then if their HRA shows certain things, they're required to do risk reduction. We're already requiring the Oceano Dunes to do a lot of emissions reductions, and that's going to have corresponding risk reductions.
But we're not looking at breathing rate and frequency of exposure and, you know, the...
Right. Medical. I think all of that is captured more in the ambient air quality standards, right? Like it's the exceedances of the state PM10 standard that are motivating our regulation of the dunes. And that state PM10 standard is designed, you know, that takes into account all this stuff, breathing rate, sensitive populations, and they set a number that's meant to protect everybody, you know, from infants and kids, elderly people, healthy people, you know, and everything in between. So I think the ambient air standard is really what, you know, the PM10 standard for ambient air is kind of what we're looking at there and where those factors are taken into account.
Thank you. Any other questions from the board? Seeing none to my right, seeing none to my left, we'll go to public comment. Anybody would wish to speak during public comment? Seeing none, any comments from the board on this item? None to my right, none to my left. I'll just say really appreciate it, Carl, and to the staff that prepared it. I know it took a lot of work to do all of this analysis, and it's a good report. So with that, we'll go ahead. I think that was just a receive and file. So we'll move on to board member items. Does any board member have a comment they would like to make? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting to our next meeting of January 22nd, 2025. And again, big thanks to Mayor Bright and Supervisor Arnold for your service on the board.